Thank you, Amelia.
See, she's very special to us, and to my wife, when I say we, my wife as well. She's been like a mother to my wife, and she's precious. We have two problems, I think, which should be the basis for reflecting on Martin's life today. One, we have a national crisis. Now, I'm not going to mince words, and I'm not going to do any political hacking, but the facts have to be told. This economy is collapsing. The situation, relatively speaking, in terms of basic economic infrastructure of the United States today is worse than in 1933 when Roosevelt came into the White House in March. That is, you look around you, infrastructure, energy, so forth, the conditions of life of our people around the world. And don't look in the big cities where they put on a facade and say things are fine. Look in the communities. For example, Detroit now has half the population it used to have. An industrial city is gone. Look around Birmingham. You see how the same thing is reported. It was never rich, but their sense of loss of this and that. That's the situation of the United States. Then you got an indifference to the problems of the United States. Okay, we have 48 at least of the 50 states are bankrupt, hopelessly bankrupt. That is, the states cannot possibly raise the tax revenue without sinking the economy further to meet the essential obligations of government. This is characteristic of at least 48 states. And it's getting worse. If you look at the cost of living, the increase of the cost of living, as compared to what is officially reported, look at the prices of food in grocery stores over the past 6 months in the United States. Look at the fact that the U.S. dollar, which not long ago was 83 cents, would buy a euro. Today it takes $1.26 or 28 cents to buy a euro. The U.S. dollar is collapsing in value. What is increasing is the amount of money associated with gambling. And the biggest form of gambling is occurring on Wall Street. The money is going into drive-up for purely speculative way on side bets on the economy to drive up the value of stock prices for some companies. And as soon as some company gets rich, the leaders of the company go to prison, like Enron. Because we have gone from the steel business to the stealing business, the nature of the economy. We're in trouble. We're in trouble on a world scale. Since January of 2002, when the present president made an unfortunate speech in the State of the Union address, the attitude toward the United States has fallen rapidly to the lowest I've ever seen among nations all over the world. Throughout Eurasia, throughout the Americas, the United States is despised where it was still at least respected or even loved before. We are in trouble. And look at the world. The world faces a great crisis, and the United States faces a great crisis in dealing with the world. The largest concentrations of population of the world are China, for example, 1.3 billion or more, India, over 1 billion. Then you have Pakistan, Bangladesh, and the countries of Southeast Asia. This is the greatest concentration of population on this planet. It's an emerging part of the world. The question is, what's the relationship of the United States to these people of Asia who represent, in by and large, different cultural backgrounds than those of us in the United States or in Western Europe? How are we going to find peace in a troubled world? How are we going to find reconciliation in a troubled world with countries which have turned against us because of the war policies of Cheney and some others? So we face the situation. Now go back a little bit to the time that Bill Clinton was inaugurated as president. Now think about something you know about. Think about the status of the Black Caucus, Legislative Caucus, and the Black Congressional Caucus in 1993 when Bill Clinton came into the White House. Now go through the list of names. Where are those people and their replacements today? There has been a winnowing out of the political achievements throughout the country of the Black caucuses. Right? This is the problem I deal with constantly. From 1996 on, it became worse, accelerated, brutally. So we do not face a new problem today, in one sense. We face the same problem in principle that Barton faced, and faced successfully. And I would propose that in the lesson of Martin Luther King and his life, there is something we can learn today which brings him back to life as if he was standing here alive today. There's something special about his life, his development, which should be captured today by us, not only in addressing the problems of our nation, which are becoming terrible, but the problems of our relationship with the world as a whole. How are we going to deal with these cultures that are different than our own? With an Asian culture, with Muslim cultures around the world, one over a billion Muslims around the world. With the culture of China, which is different than ours. The culture of Southeast Asia, which is different than ours. The cultural background. They're all human. They all have the same ultimate requirements, the same needs. But they're different cultures. They think differently. They respond to different predicates than we respond to. But we must have peaceful cooperation with these people to solve a world problem. Then you start thinking about someone like Martin. And I want to indicate in the context I just stated what the significance of Martin is today. We had no replacement for Martin. Lesson number one. Martin was a unique personality. He was not a talented person who happened to stumble into leadership and could be easily replaced by other leaders who would learn the job and take over afterward. We had no replacement. No one in the position to replace him. Many wished to be. They didn't have it. What did Martin have? What was the essence of Martin that put him above, made him something special? Let's compare three cases to get at this. One, Martin himself. The other, the case of France's famous heroine, Jeanne d'Arc. And I'm rather familiar with the details of the actual history of the Jeanne d'Arc case, which is comparable, in a sense, a very special way, to the case of Martin. And then also with a fictitious case, which points to the problem we face, the case of Shakespeare's Hamlet, especially the Hamlet of the third act soliloquy. Now, what was the issue? Martin was truly a man of God. Truly. In a way that very few people are actually able to realize in their lifetime. It wasn't just that he was a man of God, it's that he rose to the full appreciation of what that meant. Obviously, the image for him was Christ and the passion and crucifixion of Jesus Christ. That was his source of strength. He lived that. He had gone to the mountaintop at a point that he knew his life was threatened by powerful forces in the United States. And he said, I will not shrink from this mission, even if they kill me. Just as Christ said, and I'm sure that was in Martin's mind at that point. The passion and crucifixion of Christ is the image which is the essence of Christianity. It's an image, for example, in Germany or elsewhere where the Bach St. Matthew Passion is performed. It's a 2-hour performance, approximately. And those 2 hours, the audience, the congregation, the singers, the musicians, relive in a powerful way the passion and crucifixion of Christ. And this has always been important.
to relive that, to capture the essence of what Christ means for all Christians. And Martin showed that. The difference is this, and I'll come back to John Dock, called Joan of Arc in English. The difference is most people tend to believe, yes, I wish to go to heaven, or something like that. Or don't care. But they are looking for answers within the bounds of their mortal life. They're thinking of the satisfactions of the flesh, the security they will enjoy between the bounds of birth and death. Whereas the great leader, like Martin, rises to a higher level, they think of their life as the gospel presents it, as a talent. Life is a talent given to you. You're born and you die. That is your talent, what you have in that period. The question is, you're going to spend it anyway. How are you going to spend it? What are you going to spend it to secure for all eternity? What are you going to do as a mission that will earn you the place you want to occupy in eternity? Martin had a clear sense of that. That mountaintop address, for me, it struck me years ago. Clear, it was just a clear understanding of exactly what he was saying. What he was saying to others. Life is a talent. It is not what you get out of life. It's what you put into it that counts. Martin had that. That's why he was a leader. And I've known many of the other leaders with him in that period. They didn't quite have the same spark. They may have accepted the idea, they may have believed in it, but it didn't grip them the same way it did Martin. And it came to grip him, I'm sure, more and more as he took on more and more responsibilities. As a leader, you feel this, you see your people. You see the things you have to cope with, the suffering. You see the danger. And you have to find within yourself the strength not to flinch, not to compromise. Take the case of Joan d'Arc to the comparison. Joan of Arc, she called. And this is the real history. She was such a significant figure in the 15th century that her history was thoroughly documented at the time and cross-checked and so forth. She was a figure in all Christianity. She was a key figure in the history of France. Here she is, a woman, a young woman, coming from a farming background, who is inspired to believe that France must be freed from the terrible occupation of the Norman chivalry, that France must become a true nation, and it must be risen out of its condition to become a nation to take care of these problems. God wished this to happen. So she went to a series of events to a prince, who was the heir nominally to the throne of France. And she said to this prince, have gotten in there with various credentials, God wants you to become king. And he looked at her and he said, what do you want from me? I said, I don't want anything from you. God wants you to become a king. And so, because of her power of her personality and her mission, the king gave her the command of some troops in a very serious battle at that time, on the assumption that she would be killed as a leader of these troops, and that would settle the whole problem. She wasn't killed. She won the battle, personally leading the battle. And France was mobilized for its independence. The idea of its independence to a large degree as a result. Then the time came that the king was crowned, or the prince was crowned king. But then the king betrayed her to the enemies of France, to the British, the Normans. And she was put on trial by the Inquisition, which is a horrible thing. This is the worst kind of injustice you can imagine. And in the course of the trial, she was offered bait. If you will back off a little bit, girl, we won't burn you at the stake alive. And what they did, she said no. She flinched. Maybe I should compromise. She had priests in there trying to get her to compromise. She said, I won't compromise. I cannot betray my mission. She had gone to the mountaintop. I will not betray my mission. I will stay my course. So they took her. They tied her to a stake. They piled the wood on the stake. They set fire to the stake while she's alive. They cooked her to death. Then they opened the pile of wood to see if she was alive or not. They found she was dead. And they continued the process, restarted the fire, and burned her into ashes. But out of that, two things happened. Out of that, France revived and got its independence. And later got the first modern nation state of Louis XI, that is Louis XI of France. And the significance of that is this for us today. Because of that victory, because of what happened with Louis XI of France, we had the first European state in which all of the government was responsible for the general welfare of all of the people. The general welfare means exactly what it means in 1 Corinthians 13 when Paul writes of agape, or sometimes called love or charity. It's that quality. That it is not the law, it is not the rule book that counts. It's your love of humanity that counts, that you must always live for your love of humanity. And therefore, government is not legitimate, except as government is officially committed to the general welfare of not only all of the people, but also the improvement of the condition of life of their posterity. And for the first time in France, with that state, the principle of constitutional law that government cannot treat some of the people as human cattle. It is not legitimate. It is not a nation if it treats some of its people as human cattle. It must think of the general welfare of all of the people. It must be captured by a sense of responsibility to all of the people and to their posterity, because we are all mortal. And to arouse in us the passions while we are alive, which will impel us to do good, we have to have a sense that our life and the consuming of our life, the spending of our talent, is going to mean something for coming generations. The best people look for things that, like Moses, that are going to happen when he will no longer be around to enjoy them. It's this sense of immortality. It's why parents in the best degree sacrifice for their children. It's why communities sacrifice for education for their children, for opportunities for their children. You go the pangs of suffering and shortage, but you have a sense that you're going someplace, that your life is going to mean something, that you can die with a smile on your face. You've conquered death. Your life, you've spent your talent wisely. Why life will mean something better for generations to come. That was the principle. That principle inspired the plan of King Henry VII of England to do the same thing against the evil Richard III and establish England at that time as the second modern nation state. In a sense, that's what Martin was doing. The same kind of process. But now let's take the other side of the thing. Let's take the case of Hamlet. All right. Hamlet says that we have the opportunity to fight, to free ourselves from horrible conditions, but, what happens after we die? What happens beyond death? And it is the fear of what happens beyond death, which makes people cowards. And that is our problem in the United States today. It's the problem of our leadership in the Democratic Party, is the problem in the Republican Party, because not all Republicans are bad. Some of them are very good. I intend to incorporate some of them in my government. I'm not very partisan when it comes to government. I'm partisan about getting it established. So that's the point. The problem here is this. We actually believe that man is different than an animal. Do you think in the schools today, in the newspapers today, do you think that Americans believe in any significant way that man is different than an animal? We don't teach that. Look at our standard curriculum. Many of you know something about education. It's what our education policy is now nationally a crime. You don't know anything. You learn to pass a test. And you wonder if the person who designs the test knows what they're talking about. Yeah. You have tests are issued in various parts of the country not to test what you've done to the students in terms of what they know. Sometimes the students come out saying, I know nothing. Honor students say, in my years in secondary school, I learned nothing. The way it's being taught now under the standard now. What they're testing is the obedience training of the students in that school district or that part of the country as measured by some standard. Districts are competing for money. And the performance, like the dog training of the students in the school, becomes a standard at for how much money and how many honors that district will get in the following year. We are no longer concerned. We don't believe as a nation. We don't believe in developing people. We have become like Rome, ancient Rome, a society of bread and circuses. Get your crumbs and be entertained. And the entertainment gets more and more vicious as it goes along. For example, today, do people work? Is their mentality one of working? Do they believe in work? Do they believe the society gives them the opportunity to work? No. It doesn't. It gives them the opportunity to get some money. What is the biggest growth industry in the United States? Gambling. What is Wall Street? Gambling. What is Enron? Gambling. What are these guys that are going to jail in New York? Gamblers. The mentality of the country is that if you're getting lucky and winning the lottery and winning at the track, that you're getting ahead. Even though your industry is collapsing, your farm is gone, the city government can no longer afford to take care of your essential needs, we've gone into become a gambling society. We rely on what? Mass entertainment. What kind of mass entertainment? Is it something you really should be ashamed of? We no longer regard human beings as human. We no longer understand what is human. I've started a youth movement some 4 years ago. It concentrates on young people 18 to 25 years of age. That is the university age group. And as you know, people when they get to about 18 to 25 under normal conditions have passed over from thinking themselves as adolescents, as being half adults, half children, into becoming, in a sense, adults. They have adult confidence, adult impulses, and so forth. They are ready to assume responsibility in society. In a well-ordered society, everyone would have a quality type of university education accessible to them. So in order to develop the talent of each person to find out what their mission in life should be, what kind of career they should adopt, and to give them the opportunity to work through fighting that out and finding out who they really are as an adult and choosing their profession in future life on that basis. In that kind of, what I emphasize in that training is understand the difference between man and the beast. Now, I'm going to get a little bit technical at this point, but it's an important point. What is the difference between man and beast? Can you prove that man is not just an animal? And how can you prove it? If man were an ape, for example, the population of human beings on this planet would never have exceeded several million individuals. So don't make a monkey out of man. We have now over 6 billion people on this planet to take care of, and they're growing. The point is that man has been able to discover what no animal can do, to discover universal physical principles of the universe, to apply these discovered principles to make improvements in society, which increases man's power over nature, just as you can read in Genesis 1. Man and woman made equally in the image of the Creator, in the likeness of the Creator, and responsible for this function. That's what we are. When we teach physical science, when we teach classical art and things like that, when we teach history from that standpoint, we are actually imparting to young people a sense of their humanity. They are capable of reenacting the great discoveries of principle from the past, whether in art or whether in physical science. When they know that, they know the difference between themselves and the beast. They pride themselves on this. And they say, we're human. And they can look at each other with love, a kind of love which is expressed in education by the proper kind of class, in which students share in the process of fighting through the act of discovering for themselves a principle presented to them as a challenge and a paradox. I mean, there's a loving relationship, a class of size of 15 to 25, typical good university, good secondary school class, in which the students are given the responsibility, given a challenge to try to fight it through among themselves. And the good teacher tries to evoke this kind of response from among the students, find two or three in the class that will start the discussion and try to get the entire class involved in the discussion. So that what comes out of that is not memorizing something in a textbook. What comes out of that is the process of a social experience of discovering the meaning of a principle as if they had made the original discovery themselves. This is done not by teaching the individual student, though that sometimes works. It's done by getting the students to interact in the process of discussion. That's why you want a class size of between 15 and 25. Not too many to exclude the opportunity for people to participate. Not too few so you don't get the stimulation of starting the discussion. But it's this social process of relationship among people who love each other in a higher sense because they have shared the process of discovery of a principle, or they've understood something about history, but they've shared it. And the idea of sharing human knowledge as human knowledge is the essential act of loving. And you love mankind and you're happy with mankind when you have worked together to make a discovery together with people. And you realize you can rely on those people for that kind of method. You got a problem with them? Well, go back to the method. Talk to them the same way you do in the classroom. Fight it out with them. And these young people are fun. They fight it out till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I usually, when I give a lecture with these guys, they go at me for about 4 hours. I give them about 1 hour presentation or something like that, and They're at me, all over the place. But it's beautiful, it's wonderful. And I think anybody who's been in education knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's beautiful, it's wonderful. So this is the problem. We have a population, we have a world in which there's a shortage of people who actually understand fully the meaning of the difference between man and beast. That man is a creature, as defined by Genesis 1. Is made in the likeness of the Creator of the universe. This is us. We are, because of we transmit these ideas, because we transmit this work as no animal can, we love one another. We love the people who come before us. We love those who are coming after us. We care for them in a very selfish way, because in our spending our talent of life, our sense of beauty depends upon what was coming out of our life in future generations. We love children for that reason. They're our children. We love grandchildren even more than children sometimes. Because our children were able to produce these children. That's great. I mean, you love them specially, and particularly if a person become a grandparent. They love these grandchildren especially for that reason. So this kind of loving is lacking generally in the population, in leaders. Martin obviously had that. Martin was one of the rare people in his time who had a deep sense of what it is to be a human being, who had a deep sense of the lesson of the passion and crucifixion of Christ, and was able to bring to politics, which he didn't go into getting as politics as such. He was a natural leader. The natural leader is one who comes not from the political process as such, but from the people. Martin never achieved political office. Yet he was probably as important a figure of the United States as any modern president. He achieved that. His authority as a leader came from the people. He fought against the people and with the people to free them. He was a leader in a true sense. His power as a political force in the nation and in the world came from his relationship to the people. And that's our situation today, and what I'm so glad to be here and have this opportunity to be with you. Because you typify those who are struggling in this country and abroad for the so-called forgotten man. As Franklin Roosevelt was summoned in 1933 to the presidency, 80% of the population of the United States in particular, and many around the world, are the forgotten man and woman. Nobody really cares about them. Take the case of healthcare, healthcare history. Take the case of all kinds of things. The only way you can renew a nation, as Martin made a great contribution to renewing the United States, is you have to go to the forgotten man and woman, especially to the have-nots. And if you can express a loving attitude toward the problem of the have-nots, those who are on the lower side of life, then you are capable of representing the principle upon which modern government should be based. The same principle that Jeanne d'Arc made possible, in a sense, in her contribution to the emergence of France as the first modern nation state committed to the general welfare. If you want to be a true politician, you must be committed to the general welfare. You must be committed to mankind. And to be committed to mankind is to look at the person who's in the worst condition in general and uplift them. Then you really have proven that you care about the general welfare. If you don't go to those people, you're not with the general welfare. If you don't have your roots in a fight for the general welfare, you're not capable of leading our nation, which is a nation constitutionally committed to the general welfare. Martin had that. All the great leaders of history have usually come out of that kind of background. They were not born leaders. They were not elected to be leaders. Some of them became elected in the course of life, but they didn't start out and establish their leadership by being elected. They established their leadership by finding their roots in the struggle for the well-being of humanity. They became the representatives of some group struggling for their rights, or advocate of that group struggling for its rights. And they rose to a position of leadership because they had the moral character built into them in the image of the passion and crucifixion of Christ. And as they get deeper into the business, and it becomes more dangerous as they get more influential. Life does become more dangerous as you become more influential. Then they realize that they are risking their life. And they have to ask themselves, for what am I going to risk my life? For what will I not will I not betray, even at the cost of losing my life? And you're thrown right back to the question of the crucifixion and passion of Christ. And that's where we are today. Martin had that. The problem in the United States and the movement today, as we have in the movement itself, has become too, shall we say, civilized in going along to getting along with the political establishment. And is intending to believe that the road to success is going along to get along. You lose sight of the passion which should motivate the true political leader. The passion is this commitment, you have a talent. You have a sense of what your life means. You have a sense of obligation, a mission in life, to uplift the nation by uplifting a certain part of the population or all of it. And you will do nothing to betray that. That gives you power. It gives you the power of being a creature made in the image of the living of the Creator. You tap it. Martin tapped it. He was a man of God. Not just by God, but of God. He was a man who, in the course of life, destiny gave him the mission of being a man of God. And he had the strength to do that. He had the strength to walk the road of Christ, to walk through Gethsemane, to walk through the crucifixion. He had that strength, as Jean did in her own way. And that's the lesson, I believe, that has to be taught, has to be understood if we're going to save this nation. We need to tap in that power. And as I say, in all the images of recent political leaders of the United States, Martin, both as a national leader and as a world leader, which he also was in terms of his influence, is the best example of the kind of personality we must have and must develop to get us out of the horrible, frightening mess that threatens us today. Thank you very much.
Appreciate you.